You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 6th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So let me ask you guys a question.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Are you even aware of the fact that there is an Ebola outbreak going on?
Of course.
No. Jay? No.
Why? When did the outbreak happen today?
It was 20 seconds ago.
Yeah, but the thing is,
the
last outbreak, what was it, a couple years ago, was like big news, and we talked about it multiple times. And now, basically, the second largest outbreak of Ebola to ever occur is happening. It dwarfs all previous outbreaks except for the last one, and it's barely pinging the news. So get this, right now, the Democratic Republic of Congo is like the epicenter of this outbreak. Total cases as of November 6th, when we're recording it, 3,282.
Wow.
Total deaths, 2,187. So it's like two-thirds. Man. Yeah.
Is it still mostly contained to the eastern side of the country? I knew that that's where it started, and I feel like I've read that there's been like one or two scares of it showing up in Kinshasa and like being around the airports and stuff. But for the most part, that it's been kind of contained to a farther east.
It is. They're saying the outbreak is occurring in North Kivu, South Kivu, and Ituri provinces of the Republic of Congo. But yeah, they're worried about it crossing over borders and becoming more widespread. And they're like, again, and this is a little surprising to me after the last one, we've dodged a bullet and they learned their lesson. It's like, we're not, really, really responding as vigorously as we need to. I mean, we're trying. The World Health Organization has more than 650 staff on the ground, but I think it's like a slightly different part of Africa, and there's a lot of local resistance. There's a lot of distrust of Westerners, and it's impeding efforts to contain this. So
The DRC is one of the poorest and most war-torn parts of Africa. I mean, it's a very difficult place for this outbreak to happen.
Very difficult. Yeah, so the political situation is very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm. So, Steve, what about in the past few years, they've made some like crazy, awesome breakthroughs in treating Ebola. It's really encouraging.
Vaccines.
Right?
I mean, we have a vaccine now, and the vaccine works pretty well. It's like 90%, but you just got to get it to enough people.
Yeah, it's tough.
No, it's totally a political problem at this point,
Okay.
Yeah, it's like trying to feed the people as well. It runs into a lot of the same oppositions and roadblocks.
But see, even though we have a vaccine, the thing is, if this outbreak became an epidemic, if the number of people who would need to be protected jumped to the millions, we wouldn't have enough vaccine to go around. Right? Would we be able to manufacture enough to prevent an epidemic from spreading? Probably not. We just better hope that they keep this contained.
I imagine there are all sorts of travel warnings in place regarding...
Congo. Yeah, don't go there.
Well, I have a friend who just went, and I mean, I think there was some risk and he had to get special clearances, but he stayed on the western side. He stayed in Kinshasa, which is a major city, and just went into the parks around there, and it was for work and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, there were fears. There were like legit fears. And I remember him even thinking like, should I get vaccinated? Like, this is a complicated time and situation, because you don't want to take vaccines away from people who live there.
Right.
Especially when your risk is low.
Mm-hmm. Right,
but,
unnecessary.
I think there's just a conscientiousness that comes with doing a lot of world traveling and being really aware. And of course, I think Ebola is also one of those diseases that's like scary to us because it's so, quote, exotic to us. It's scary because it's a bad disease, but it's
scared
also like
to anybody.
There's a lot of fear of the unknown. I think a lot of times in film and in books, they make the hemorrhagic fever seem like violent and like really, and they make it look like just blood shoots out of your eyes the whole time. And I mean, this has been a big concern with a lot of science writers and a lot of health experts, that the way that we show Ebola in the media is actually not reflective of reality. And that doesn't help the situation at all. Do you remember early on when we had healthcare workers that contracted Ebola working there, and whoever, I don't remember if this was Trump's presidency, I think it might have been, but whoever was in charge was like, they can't come back to America for treatment. We're like, what? We have to bring them back for treatment. Like, there's a legitimate fear that like everyone in America is going to get Ebola. And like, that's an unfounded fear. We need to take reasonable precautions, but...
Yeah, I think we also need to be reminded that there are people out there who are coming up with hoax cures for Ebola, making all kinds of claims that their water will do this or these nuts will protect
you. So sad.
Yeah.
And Kara, it may not be that, the infection or disease to end all disease. If it becomes airborne, that's an entirely different beast. That would be horrific if this became airborne and you don't need contact with, like, say, body fluids. That would be really bad.
Yeah, but is there
a
reason to believe that that's going to happen?
Right, yeah.
There was a medical facility, I think it was in D.C., that actually produced a strain of airborne Ebola, but it was not deadly. But it did become airborne. All the evidence pointed to the fact that different monkeys became infected with Ebola, and the only connection with the original group that were infected was the air handling system, and that was it.
Are you talking about the hot zone?
Yes,
that's not a real book.
You mean it's fiction?
Yeah,
I think it was fictionalized into a movie, but the hot zone book that I read referenced this legit event.
Oh, okay. Because Hot Zone was heavily, it has real stuff that happened in it, but it was, they call it a terrifying true story, but there was all sorts of fictionalized stuff in it.
But Bob, to clarify, in that study that you're referencing, Ebola didn't become airborne. What they suspect is that the Ebola virus was spread to very nearby animals through droplets. The virus was suspended in droplets. And that's always a question, even for non-airborne viruses that spread with respiratory fluids. If you sneeze or cough or vomit, how long can the virus survive in liquid particles, and how big do those particles need to be? That's the question with Ebola, not is it airborne or can it become airborne? Is it, this droplet suspended in droplet spread, how much of a threat is that? Could be a little bit of a threat, not that big a deal, and it's still a little controversial.
So, but that's an interesting question. How does something become airborne? And I'm sure we've studied that. And is Ebola taking one of those vectors?
Well, Ebola is a zoonotic infection, right? This is an infection that has spilled over and will continue to spill over, which is why we can't eradicate it. It's a virus. And there are different filoviruses, not just Ebola. So there's Marburg. That's a really scary one, too.
Yeah.
There have been other ones, Sudan virus. And these are zoonotic infections. The vector is still a little bit cloudy, but we think it might be bats. And they spill over periodically. We know that certain apes or primates can contract it. We also know that it is viable or it can be contracted by people. And this is evolution, right? This is what happens. Like, it became spilled over because of evolution. It could become airborne because of evolution. Like, viruses can mutate. They can change. And they can change a lot faster than larger organisms. I think the biggest thing is that we always have to match, like, measured responses against panic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and those two things are almost equally important when it comes to an outbreak or when it comes to epidemiology in general, because you don't want people to be so scared that they do crazy stuff in response to viral outbreak.
Right.
But you also want to make sure that people understand the severity and they take all the precautions that they need to take.
Well, the problem with Ebola is it's been sensationalized. I mean, like you said before, it's not the big bad thing that's going to kill everyone.
And it's not how it was written about in Hot Zone. I mean, it is to some extent. Remember, they were looking at Ebola Zaire, which was a different type of the virus.
It's a nasty strain.
Yeah. But even when we look at, movies about it or movies that reference it, they show blood coming out of every orifice. And they're like, yeah, it's a hemorrhagic fever. It doesn't look like that when somebody's dying of Ebola.
I never turn to Hollywood for my medical. Yeah.
Right here, The Hot Zone, terrifying true story, best-selling 1994 nonfiction thriller by Richard Preston. That's what it says on Wikipedia.
Well, no, I know, but it's highly fictionalized.
But Bob, there is no documented case of a virus completely changing its mode of transmission. And virologists are saying, do not worry about Ebola becoming airborne. It is not a plausible scenario. It is
okay.
The probability is so remote, it's not worth worrying about.
Probability of what specifically?
Of it mutating features that will enable it to be transmitted through airborne transmission. So just don't worry about that. What we want to worry about is Ebola getting into a big city. That's what we want to worry about. When it was in the rural areas, there were dozens of cases, tens of cases. When it got into a town, that's when we jumped to thousands of cases. If it gets into a city, then we could jump to hundreds, to tens of thousands of cases. Or maybe, you know, if it gets into a city with an airport, you know, that's when we, it's a problem. That's really what we need to worry about.
And just to be really, really clear about Hot Zone, because I don't want to denigrate, it's actually a really important book, and it talks a lot about how we do epidemiology and how we do disease research. The virus that was actually infecting the monkeys in the Hot Zone was Reston virus, which doesn't affect people. They thought that it was Ebola Zaire because it was acting very so. At first, they thought it was, I think, Marburg virus or some other filovirus. And then when it was acting differently and it was testing differently, they were like, holy crap, we've got Ebola Zaire here. But it turns out that it was actually Reston virus, which is a hemorrhagic fever that only affects monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a fear, right, that there can be a spillover event or there as well. But like, just to be clear, that wasn't even Ebola.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And I'm looking, I'm Googling around for this the Hot Zone. And yeah, there's some people are definitely criticizing and saying that it was very sensationalized and sensationalistic.
But it's an important book.
Yeah.
I think if you want to read about Ebola really deeply and you want to learn an awful lot about it, I highly, highly recommend the book called Spillover by David Quammen. He's a stellar science writer. It's, I think, an example of some of the best science writing about infectious diseases. And it teaches all about how viruses mutate and how infection spills over into human beings. He did a whole really important chapter on Ebola. This book's a little bit older, so when this new Ebola outbreak came up, they actually clipped out that chapter and reworked it a little bit, and you can buy that separately, just the Ebola section from Spillover. So there you go.
So, and yeah, just to end this with the latest update, so the World Health Organization just recently announced that the number of new cases of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo is decreasing finally. So we're probably getting under control. And this is due largely to the fact that they vaccinated 240,000 people with the new vaccine. So that was the primary method of containing it, and it seems to be working. But still, thousands of cases. This was a major outbreak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So scary.
I know, and so sad. Soon on the last one, we got to really keep an eye on it.
Yep, yeah. and it has, this one did not grip the the media consumer like the last one.
Yeah, because it's the second biggest, right? Who cares about the second biggest?
Well, and I think we do. We get this fatigue, you know? I think we see this a lot, you know, not to get political, but we see it with school shootings, and it's really sad, and it's a really difficult psychological thing to grapple with, that things are horrifying to us, and then the more that they happen and the more that they get normalized, not that they're any less horrifying, but they can't beat out the rest of the news cycle anymore.
They're less newsworthy. Yeah,
and then you don't even read about them.
All right, we got a great show. Let's move on. We're going to do a 5 to 10 year segment. So I found a news item that we talked about in 2010, so 9 years ago, about using stem cells to grow livers for transplantation. This is was, I think, one of the first times that we reported on an idea that I think we've discussed multiple times on the show since, about taking the cells, you know, taking an organ, then you remove all the cells, so you're left with just the connective tissue, and then you use that connective tissue as a scaffold.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Right. And then
I've read about that a lot. What's cool? Is that still a viable technique?
You transplant, you know, stem cells onto the scaffold and try to create an organ that would be immunologically compatible with the donor. Right. So the idea would be you get a liver that has your cells, your liver cells in it, not somebody else's liver cells, so you don't have to worry about rejection. So there was, we were reporting on a study in from 2010 in which researchers at Mass General were able to create, they decellularized a liver, and then they used it as a scaffold in order to transplant new hepatocyte stem cells. And it survived for several hours, right? And that was considered to be an advance. I wouldn't call it a breakthrough, but it was progress. So what I did was, okay, so where is, it's been 9 years, where's this research now? And I could not find really that we've made any progress in the last 9 years. So the actual lead author on this study, that was the last time he published anything on that technique. All of his publications since then have been on just preserving donor livers, right? So he's got this, what he does, liver transplant. So he's like, you know, how do we preserve donor livers better? Do we freeze them? Whatever. So that's been the focus of his research. And the idea of using a decellularized scaffolding, he didn't publish anything since his 2010 study. I just looked up the topic itself to see what's being published recently on this. And it's still very, very preliminary kind of research, you know, not anywhere near producing like an actual liver. Just researchers are working on trying to figure out just the basic technology, the precursors to where we could even start to think about doing this. So that's very little progress that I've been able to see in 9 years in terms of the overall arc of where we need to get to. So again, it's always hard to extrapolate into the future, but I think what we can say is that this research project is progressing on the order of decades. You know,
this is
the kind of thing where we're going to look back 30 years from now, and it'll be like something, you know what I mean? Like we've talked about news items recently where some technology is finally coming into use, and if you look back, it's like, wow, like the first person to bring this up was like 40 years ago. You know, like that's yeah, kind of the stage that we're at now. I think we'll be looking back at 30 or 40 years.
Sure, look at high temperature superconductivity.
Isn't that an artifact of money?
No, it's really technology. Partially. I mean, this is hard to do. This is really hard to do. That's what it is. Obviously, money always will. That's the fuel that will, you know, accelerate or slow it down. And this is a separate question. This is a complicated question. You know, money follows what's plausible. It also follows interest, you know, demand.
And return on investment, too.
And so I think that this is a subjective perception thing, but from reading news items and from talking to researchers, I think we might be moving into the post-hype phase with stem cells.
Hmm.
I actually had a researcher tell me that he's no longer thinking this is going to take 20 to 30 years. He's thinking this may never work, right? Like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, certain stem cell applications, it's actually misleading to say this will take 20 years. It's more accurate to say we don't even know if this is going to work.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's
tell me that?
There's serious hurdles, you know? Conceptually, it's nice. You take cells, you turn them into other cells, and you grow organs and do all that neat stuff. But using our existing technology and existing concepts, it's just, you know, it's so, the progress is so slow, and we're running into so many roadblocks. You can't even say if this is going to work out.
It often becomes, how many orders of magnitude more complicated is it than you thought?
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
You ever been punched in the liver?
No.
Don't. It's an awful, awful feeling. No.
Yeah.
Many a fighter have been knocked out by being punched in the liver.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's funny to think about. You know, they were knocked out by being punched in, like, an abdomen organ. You know what I mean?
Well, you get, like, the quote-unquote wind knocked out of you. That's like when you get a punch to the stomach. I know, but it's not always literally getting the wind knocked out of you. It just means you took a blow to the abdomen that took you down. So, you know, that's a little disappointing, you know, but this is why we're always cautious. And you know, going back to our discussion at the time, we were appropriately cautious. Still, I think maybe more optimistic than I would. I think the 9 years has made me less optimistic about this approach, not more optimistic. And I think that we've discussed previously about the various options. I think genetically engineering animals and then harvesting their organs is probably a better approach than using the scaffolding approach. I don't think the scaffolding approach is really going to pan out, if I had to guess. I think it might be a dead end.
Well, I mean, they did. There was a study I read about recently today where they 3D printed a rat liver. So, I mean, that's just there's a completely different approach to this whole scaffolding idea. And they've done it. I mean, they literally have already 3D printed a rat liver. I don't know how successful the actual liver was, but I mean, that's completely different, right, than the scaffolding idea.
These are partial livers that they're doing. It's more like liver tissue. So you can't do the full architecture of a liver with 3D printing yet. But that is a different approach. You're correct, and maybe that approach has more promise. It's more like an organ mimic, really, than the organ itself. But the question is, could you 3D print something with stem cells that will have some organ-like functionality, right? That's kind of what we're trying to work
it's
on.
It's saying that they
implanted, still great.
Yeah, 3D bioprinted liver tissue into rats.
Yeah, not a liver, but liver tissue. That's a, tissue is not an organ.
Wait, but your skin is an organ.
Yeah, the skin's kind of different. It's the skin is tissue and it's an organ. And it, there is some complexity to the skin as well. I'm not trying to make it simple, but it doesn't have the architecture of like a heart or a lung or a liver.
Yeah, you're right. Well, I don't know. I mean, look, my take on this is I'm a little disappointed because it sounded very promising.
Oh my God, yeah.
It's funny that you brought this up, Steve, because I just assumed that it was progressing. In the back of my mind.
Yeah,
just you know, it's weird. You have like a some type of temporal.
That's our bias.
Yeah. There's a temporal thing that happens, right? Like you hear something and then you get a sense of like, yeah, it's been a while, that years since I read about that. I remember it first hit my mind. And my brain just naturally evolved it to thinking, yeah, they're probably getting close to doing the scaffolding thing. And now it's like, oh, the whole thing fell down like a house of cards.
Well, I'll never forget, you know, we lived through the hydrogen economy hype of 2000, you know, in the year 2000, if we said, hey, in 2020, what do you think? You think we'll be all driving around in hydrogen fuel cell cars? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Right. If you said in 2020, we'll basically be no closer to the hydrogen economy than we are today, we would have thought that was crazy time.
Yeah. But that because, liver, that's coming along.
No, but they hit a technological hurdle. It's hard to control and store in a usable form that much hydrogen in something that is not too big or too heavy, you know. We still haven't really cracked that problem, and it limits the utility of hydrogen fuel cell cars.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a balance too. I mean, who the hell would have predicted CRISPR in 2000?
Well, that I know, you're right.
So there's a little bit of a balance, you know, not as much as I would like, but there's, you know, and cell phones. I mean, I got my little pet cell phone right here with me. I'm petting it and kissing it. I mean, it's just such a huge part of your life, or at least my life.
No, that's right. The things that we predict may not come true, and things that we don't predict blindside us and come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Sort of, yeah.
I hate what cell phones did to our culture.
Well, you hate your cell phone.
I do hate my particular cell phone.
You have a love-hate relationship with it?
I mean, cell phones, without a doubt, have altered our culture in a way that I interpret as negative. I don't like it. I don't like it. You ever see the
net negative?
Kara, didn't we talk about this on the show? A photographer took pictures of people and they photoshopped the cell phones out of their hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And they look like, they all look like they're seeing a ghost or something. It just look like there's something void on people's faces.
Meh. I think you're catastrophizing.
That's what it looks like when you look at people's faces when they're engaged in conversation half the time, too. I think that it's just one of these, like, all right, grandpa, like, this is what it's like now. And unfortunately, there are certain shitty things that come along with it, but there's so much good stuff that
comes
along with
it, too. Double-edged sword, definitely.
Yeah. And I think it's hard. It's a massive change that occurred during our lifetimes, and it affected so much. So it's a hard thing, right? But I can't imagine. There are times where I am so lost and I am so dependent on my GPS that I'm like, what would I have done? Honestly.
Yeah.
Like, it's the middle of the night. I don't have a map in my car. I couldn't have bought one. Like, I would have had to go to a payphone and call somebody and tell them what streets I'm on and have them like find me somehow.
Yeah, we lived through that. Kara.
That was every day. And Jay, also think of it from this angle. The overt physicality of a smartphone will go away, I believe. I mean, eventually it'll be integrated to such an extent that you really won't even see it. You know, like, say, like, in your glasses or in your contacts, you know, a lot of the functionality of the phone will kind of, like, be absorbed in a way that you won't even see it.
So yeah, Bob, you love making predictions, Bob. You love making predictions about future technology that will probably not come true.
That's me, man. I do. I think it'll happen. I don't know when, but, I think that seems very reasonable.
I know. We won't be walking down the sidewalks. We'll be riding Segways.
Oh, yeah, Segways. Yes. Yeah. I remember those.
So you're comparing augmented reality glasses with a Segway. Okay.
Yes,
time will tell, brother.
That's my point, is time will tell. We can't tell right now, because until you try to incorporate them into your lives, you don't know what the effect. Who would have thought? We talked about this all the time.
I will rarely say that will definitely happen in this time frame.
Look at the popularity of texting. Wouldn't have predicted that. You can't predict that people are going to use technology.
I'm not disagreeing. I think cell phones will undergo radical changes in the next, say, 20 to 30 years.
Well, that's the only thing we can say with some confidence is that things will change. How? Who knows?
Well, right.
All right. Let's move on to some news items.
Yes.
And Bob, you're going to start us off with a discussion of bacterial colonies.
Yeah, this one was had implications that are awesome and scary. Scientists have engineered bacterial colonies to replicate the one aspect of multicellular life that has not been replicated in bacteria yet. And this could potentially lead to bacterial multicellular life forms in the future that we could, I think we could just scarcely imagine. And who knows? I'm not making any definite predictions here, Steve, but I think they could be, it could be major milestones in synthetic biology that who knows what kind of changes they will bring. So this research comes from synthetic biologist Matthew R. Bennett and other scientists based at Rice University, and you can read about it in the journal Nature Chemical Biology. The article is entitled A Synthetic System for Asymmetric Cell Division in E. Coli. So now we all love bacteria, right?
Well, of course.
You should if you don't. But as cool and as complex as bacteria and archaea are, they are still unicellular, right? These are just individual cells, except for all intents and purposes. But what if they weren't? What if they were more like multicellular life? What would that take?
So you're saying no longer bacteria?
Well, not bacteria as not conventional bacteria. Or archaea for sure. So if you look at multicellularity itself, there's three major ways that it distinguishes itself from unicellular life like bacteria. Bacteria, for example, doesn't have intercellular communication like multicellular life. There's no cell adhesion where the cells kind of glom together to form an organ, say. There are things like bacterial mats, but that is different than multicellular cell adhesion. And there's also the third thing is asymmetric cell division. Genetic engineering has already created bacteria. You may have missed this. I certainly did some of this. They've already engineered bacteria that have this intercellular communication between the cells or among the cells and the cell adhesion. And that they've done this. They've engineered them separately into bacteria. And now for the first time, asymmetric cell division has been programmed into bacteria. That has been done this year for the first time. So asymmetric cell division simply means that when a cell produces, it produces two daughter cells with different cellular destinies. So they're not clones of the parent. One may be, but the other one is destined for something different. So stem cells, stem cells are classic examples of asymmetric division. Each one can create two distinct daughter cells. One is a copy of the parent stem cell. The second daughter cell is programmed to differentiate into a specialized cell, such as a blood cell, a bone cell, heart muscle cell, etc. And that's something that bacteria do not do, but now they can be engineered to do that. To take a bacterium and manipulate the DNA makeup of the daughter cells, Bennett and his team created what they're calling a genetic circuit. This circuit can create genetically distinct cells of E. coli when the bacterium divides. So in a quote from their paper, we engineered an inducible system that can bind and segregate plasmid DNA to a single position in the cell. And upon cell division, co-localized plasmids are kept by one and only one of the daughter cells. The other daughter cells receives no plasmid DNA and is irreversibly differentiated from its sibling. So that all that gobbledygook means that some of the DNA in the cell is segregated into one part of the cell so that after cell division, only one of the daughter cells has that DNA and therefore will have a different destiny, can become differentiated or specialized, unlike the parent or the other daughter cell. So now this advance means that we may soon be able to reprogram bacteria and archaea to exhibit these three hallmarks of multicellular life at the same time. So in some way, they will be able to communicate together. They will adhere together not unlike organs in animals. And they will also experience asymmetric cell division. Bennett said regarding this, if we can control all those things together, we can talk about engineering interesting multicellular life forms. It starts to feel a bit like science fiction for sure. And I totally agree. This is so fascinating. I think archaea, especially the archaea, are they're like bacteria, but they're more ancient and more. They have much more diversified metabolisms. When you hear of creatures, organisms like extremophiles, a lot of these are archaea. They can do amazing things, such as living in acid or reconstituting their DNA after it's been scrambled by ionizing radiation. Amazing things. Now imagine if you take little little building blocks like that and create, you know, multicellular organisms out of them. Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what people will do with it? But I think we can say that it looks like it's a reasonable extrapolation that we can start messing with that in the not too near future. And who knows? I know I'd love to see some science fiction treat some of these ideas seriously and just speculate on what can be created and what kind of crazy things could happen or what utility they may have. Who knows?
True. Like if asteroid wipes out all life on Earth except bacteria, you know, in a billion years, would they re-evolve multicellularity?
I'm sure they would.
Well,
I'm not so sure.
Yeah, it took a lot of years before that happened. I mean, we had single-celled life for billions of years, and then who knows? It might be such a fluke for multicellularity to actually take off and proliferate. But right, Steve, how long did it take before that happened? And of course, you know, once that happened, it's like whoa, a whole new explosion of possibility.
You know, scientists have on, I don't know, Europa or Enceladus. Like, obviously, we don't even know the odds of there being life there. But if we did find life in these regions, it would overwhelmingly likely just be unicellular, right?
We don't know. We don't know. We have one, an N of one. So yeah, we right. have no I, way of
yeah,
extrapolating.
You could guess and say, yeah, probably it's unicellular. But I don't care what it is, as long as it's, you know, one or the other. That would be the find of the millennium right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Yep. Bacteria are endlessly cool.
And I love my bacteria cloud.
Yeah.
Love it.
You never forgot that talk I gave, did you, Evan?
Oh, that's a great talk.
Evan, it's funny you say that because I just think of that all the time.
Really?
I do as well.
Bacterial cloud.
Yeah, because you're walking through everybody else's. Like you're just, you know, when you get intimate with someone.
We're all Pigpen.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Basically.
Yep.
That's so gross.
Yeah. Well, no, but it's
no. It's beautiful.
It's not gross.
You know what?
It's not gross when you love the people that you know, like with my kids and my wife. It's like, you know, their bacteria cloud is a part of my reality.
It's true, and you're always sick, Jay.
Well, I'm sick all the time because I have kids that go to
school
where they
yeah.
It's a petri dish.
Oh, when I'm at the airport and somebody is like hacking within any sort of like, you know, remote arm's reach, I do that thing where I just like stop breathing and walk as quickly as I can out of that area and exhale really, really, really long before I take my next breath.
Or when someone sneezes, I duck for cover, pull my coat over my head.
Steve, what was that quote? Something about every breath you take. You're probably inhaling an oxygen molecule that Aristotle breathed in his life.
Yeah,
that's right.
That, right?
Or Ben Franklin.
We're all sharing shit, people.
Yeah, at that point when it's vintage, it's like not even gross anymore. You're right. When you think
about
it, you're like, no, that's just cool.
We're global.
Dinosaur pee. Yeah, drinking dinosaur pee.
Yeah, it was Caesar's last breath.
Every time
you breathe in, you are breathing in air molecules that were in Caesar's last breath. Statistically, that is true. Okay, Kara. Does learning how to play a musical instrument make you smarter?
We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Done. Moving on.
Some people might argue yes.
Well, I like these short ones.
No.
Isn't that sad, though, when that really ultimately is the outcome? I mean, it's not sad, but we love these big, catchy headlines. But the truth is, it's really, really complicated. And ultimately, the question that a recent study answers is not whether or not music lessons really make children smarter, but whether or not we've been looking at the data that we have collected previously the right way, and what kinds of inferences can we draw from, you know, the kind of plethora of studies that have been developed to ask this very question, because I think it's been a long held belief that if you, you know, listen to music while you study, or if you actually even more so practice music, especially as a child. So whether you're playing violin or piano or singing, you're taking lessons, you're reading music, you're, you know, training your hands or your breath, that that's actually going to have an impact on your intelligence. So there's a researcher named Glenn Schellenberg, who's kind of at the center of this article that was written in UnDark. And Glenn Schellenberg has been himself, he's been a musician for like his whole life. And he, in like 2004, I think, did this early study that sort of was a benchmark study in the field, where he took 144 children. And he said, I'm tired of this idea that we're looking at correlational data and that we're only looking at kids who already took music lessons and comparing their, you know, intelligence on whatever measure — that's a whole other conversation we could have — but whatever their measure of intelligence is against kids who didn't take music lessons. But of course, these are self-selecting groups. There's nothing random about this. So he was like, I want to try and design a pretty solid scientific study where I'm going to take a group of kids and randomly assign them to groups. One group is going to get keyboard lessons. One group is going to get voice lessons. Another group is going to get drama lessons. So this is going to be an artistic endeavor, but not necessarily, or not at all, with regards to music. And then another group is not going to do any extracurriculars for a whole year. And then we're going to see what happens on these IQs of these kids. And he actually found a small effect size, but a generalizable effect size across all of the subtests of the IQ test that he used, across the index scores, across the standardized measurements in this pre and post test, that the kids in the music groups only, but not in the drama or the straight control group, exhibited a greater increase in IQ. Interestingly, something that wasn't mentioned in this article, the kids in the drama group showed a substantial improvement in their social adaptive behavior that was not evident in the other kids, which, you know, kind of makes sense because it's more of a team sport, as it were, a team lesson than music, which is more isolated. And you have to kind of do the, especially if you're doing improv, you know, yes, and there's a lot of interesting ideas there. But anyway, so he does the study. Everybody goes, holy crap. I guess it's the case that, you know, music makes you smarter. Music lessons make you smarter. And then more studies start cranking out. Remember, this is 2004. This is a long time ago now. It doesn't feel like it, but yeah, that was 15 years ago. And then more studies start cranking out, and they're like, meh, we're not seeing this. A really important one had 1,000 subjects instead of 114 subjects. And they're saying, we're not so sure that this is holding water. So this researcher, Schellenberg, recently in 2019 published a new study. But this new study is actually a completely different angle, where he's asking the question, how much do neuroscientists and psychologists make, sort of use language when they publish that leads people to believe that there is a causal link when all they've actually shown in their study is a correlational link?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
All
so
the
he's
time.
Saying, yeah, there are so many studies out there where people have looked at music lessons and intelligence, and they make a lot of statements about it, but they're not doing the kind of science that you can actually make a case for causation with. They're only looking at correlation. And so he goes through, weirdly, 114 journal articles, which — oh, there was 144. I was going to say, that is a strange coincidence. 144 kids in his previous study, 114 journal articles in this new study that were published since 2000. And he had basically his team code them. And he coded them for terms that imply causation. So not just for the word prove or cause or things like that, but other terms like facilitate, promote, strengthen, enhance. So these are terms, you know, verbs that show that the link is actually one that is a directly causal link. And these he was looking for in the title and the abstract of the paper only. And then, interestingly, he categorized the papers as either neuroscience or psychology studies. And the way he did that is that the neuroscience studies employed EEG or MRI or some other neuroimaging method, or the study appeared in a journal that had brain, neuroscience, or a synonym of those words in the title of the journal. Everything else, he just like dumped in the bucket of psychology. Okay, does that make sense to everybody so far?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He didn't tell his assistants what he was looking for. He just had them code. That's all. So they were doing this blind, which was pretty important for his study. And then at the end, he compared how many journal articles versus neuroscience articles, or sorry, how many neuroscience journal articles, journals.
Yeah, journals. I love journals. That.
It's a great shorthand.
It's a great word.
It's a journal. It's peer reviewed. Okay. How many neuroscience versus psychology articles made this sort of fallacious claim that music training has a causal effect when they didn't actually study that? And what he found, this is really interesting, right, is that basically the majority of them did this. So, as Steve said, most of them. Where do you think the, and I want to ask like Evan, or maybe Bob, this question. Mm-hmm. Where do you think that you saw more prevalence, this is such a good science or fiction, of this overselling in the neuroscience articles or in the psychology articles?
Number three, I mean, psychology articles.
Neuroscience.
Neuroscience.
Mm.
Which is kind of counterintuitive to a lot of people, I think. For me, having been in both fields, it makes perfect sense because psychologists as a field are sort of always under this pressure to prove that they're quote unquote real science to begin with. And actually, when I was training both in neuroscience and in psychology, I've done graduate training in both, I found that psychology had a much more stringent statistical curriculum, that psychology better prepared me for publishing, for understanding effect sizes, for understanding the differences between causation and correlation, and for being very careful with my language. Whereas in neuroscience, I think because the field is so much more respected in general as being real science, I think that the researchers can get away with being a little bit lazy.
Interesting.
About this stuff. Like you can. Yeah, you can do like an fMRI study with an N of 3 and people go, well, that's science. You know what I mean? Like, I've just learned so much from that. And it is interesting that there are different standards on the field. And so, you know, this article that was written in UnDark, they talked to a few different people who agree or who disagree. Some people say that Schellenberg, this researcher who early on was studying and kind of was like, look, there is a link, a causal link between music lessons and an improvement in intelligence, is now saying, I think we have been way overzealous. We have been really not careful within this field and we've taken the ball and run with it uncritically. So there's a few different researchers that the writer of this article interviewed that said totes agree. And there are a few that were like, neuroscientists aren't stupid, even though he thinks we are. And the truth is, just looking at those key terms takes out all nuance and all context. So yes, maybe they were trying to sell the study in the headline or in the abstract, but that's kind of unfair because it might have been more tempered throughout the writing. But then, of course, I think a fair counter argument to that is, unfortunately, most people only read the abstract, even scientists. And so you've got to be pretty tempered in your abstract too, or people are going to run with it. And so it's like, we've got to be careful about that. But regardless, when it really comes down to the question of whether there is a mechanism in place, whether it is true that doing music, practicing it all the time, improves intellectual outcomes, it's actually a very hard thing to study because the only real way to understand that is if you do like longitudinal studies, and you simply can't control longitudinal studies in people. It's very rare to be able to look at causal links in longitudinal studies because people are going to live their lives the way they choose to live their lives. And then you're going to look at the data after the fact. So if kids choose to take music lessons, or if they continue with those music lessons? Are there intrinsic personality traits? Are there things that are fundamental to the child? Or are there other factors that come into play that would also then account for the change or the increase or just the fundamentally different level of intelligence? It's just very hard to tease that kind of stuff out. So there is apparently a really big study that's going on right now in Germany called the Audio and Neuroplasticity of Musical Learning Research Project, where they're looking at how the regular practice of music affects hearing ability and non-musical faculties like creativity, intelligence, reading, spelling, calculation. They're using 160 children, but again, they really, and they're doing all sorts of cool stuff with MRI and with psychological tests and auditory tests. And the way that they were able to do this is that there was a project in Germany called For Every Child an Instrument that was offered in certain regions. So they're able to look at the kids in certain regions who got these instruments and got this kind of training, and then kids from other regions where they didn't get that. But of course, this is not as controlled as this early study, and there have been very few very controlled studies, and I think no controlled studies that go on beyond like a year. And so it's a pretty interesting question even to this day.
So Kara, did he conclude that being trained as a neuroscientist causes people to make this mistake?
I think that based on his responses now, like his kind of sea change and the way that he is like, yeah, hi. I don't think that that we can say that musical ability causes increases in intelligence. I think that's a really big jump. I don't think he would say that being a neuroscientist causes that either. I do love one of the quotes, though. I have to give you guys this quote. He was saying, you know, the question of whether, as somebody who started taking piano lessons at the age of 5 and got up every morning at 7 to practice, that experience changed me and made me part of who I am today. The question is whether those kinds of experience do so systematically across individuals and create exactly the same changes. And I think that is a huge leap of faith. And then he says, I love this, neuroscientists, they go, personality, that's not my issue. But personality has to be instantiated in the brain. He argued, it's not in the knee. Like, I don't know why I just laughed so loud when I read that. Like, because it's true, some neuroscientists want to say that there's literally no such thing as personality. Like, because I can't see it on a scan, it's not a
thing. They're focusing their questions. I remember, like, we talked about this with Richard Wiseman, and because he is a behavioral social psychologist, right?
Yeah.
And I asked him, what do you think is, like, you know, is going on in the brain? He's like, I don't care.
Exactly. That's not
I don't care what's going on in the brain. There's nothing to do with what I'm studying, because you can't, like, go in and change the anatomy of the brain. What you can
not
do
yet
is influence people's behavior. So that's what I'm interested in. So he was very matter of fact about it. He doesn't give a crap about neuroanatomical correlates at all. It's not his specialty. It's not what he's researching. And I do think there is a little bit of a risk of being too narrow and not looking at it in multiple different ways. At least I'm not saying you have to do the research, but you should maybe like talk to people who are doing the research.
Yeah.
And try to correlate things.
When it comes to certain constructs, I mean, I was just talking about this in my CogSci course, when it comes to certain constructs that we can't necessarily quote unquote see in the brain yet because they're too complex. Like, how do you measure creativity in the brain? How do you even measure creativity outside of the brain? I hate that construct. I'm doing a study or a project on it right now, and I literally hate my life. It's so hard. Creativity isn't
a
thing.
It's a hard thing to operationalize. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Like, is it like willpower?
Exactly. And that's where things become really, really complicated. Just because we don't know how to measure it doesn't mean it doesn't exist in some form as a construct. You know what I mean? Just because I can't touch it and just because I can't see it in the brain doesn't mean it's not an important construct to investigate, to talk about, and to try and understand. And so I do think that you sometimes see these like turf wars with different fields where they're trying to answer similar questions using different approaches. And it's pretty interesting to see when they get like snide in published articles. It always makes me laugh when you read these like kind of passive aggressive things in a sophisticated academic journal. You're like, ooh, the claws came out. But yeah, that's actually not the point of this. The point of this is that we still don't know, but it may be the case that we have been overconfident and we've been using language that makes other people come out with an overconfident view simply because we're not being very careful about how we talk about these things in our published outcomes. And that's, I think, really dangerous.
Yeah. And if I had to say, though, from looking at again, all the research, not just the question of music, I think that the research is converging on this consensus that whatever you do makes you better at the thing that you do. And it doesn't really transfer generically to intellectual skills or something as vague as intelligence. Right?
Yeah, the problem, because when the thing that you're doing is so complex and it has subcomponents, right? If you're going to start to break it down into its subcomponents, because when you study music, you are actually studying certain fundamentals of mathematics and certain fundamentals of all these different things like hearing and ability to perceive. So that's where it gets complicated. But yes, to think that studying music is going to give you better recall, for like, if you're a violinist, it's going to give you better recall for synonyms of, you know, words. Like, what? Why would you do that?
It pretty clearly doesn't transfer to unrelated skills. But where it does get tricky is when the skill is itself pretty broadly applicable. Like, what if the skill that you're learning is how to learn stuff, or like how to study, or, you know, or how to pay attention for extended periods of time, you know, how to be goal-oriented.
That's
going to
be translatable almost across everything. Like, if you're improving your attentional capabilities, I can't think of a cognitive function that doesn't require that.
Right, exactly. So, but it's still early days, I think, in this research, but I think I would abandon the hope that you're going to be able to do some magical, scientifically formulated puzzle or whatever that's going to give you, make you quote-unquote smarter.
Absolutely.
The truth
is, if you want to study music to become a better musician, that's amazing, and you should do that. Don't take music classes if you want to be better in algebra. Why don't you get an algebra tutor?
Yeah, study algebra.
Like, you know? But if you're ultimately thinking, okay, it's got positive net benefits across the board, yeah, it probably is going to give you some improvement in other areas, but that's not why you should do it. You should do it for the love of the thing you're doing.
Yeah, I also think there's the generic doing stuff is better than not doing stuff benefit as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
You have to control for in all these studies.
If you're using your brain and you're using different parts of your brain, then you know that development is going to help a lot of other stuff too. It's not so completely discrete. When you learn music, you're using different parts of your brain to do different things. It's not just like one thing. So I'm listening to you tell this story and explain the science, and I'm thinking like, yeah, but, you know, could you be rock climbing and get the same benefit? Could you be, you know, learning a foreign language and get the same benefit?
Yeah, what do you mean by the
measuring?
What do you mean by the same benefit? You get different benefits.
Right. I guess you're right. It's a different collection of benefits. So sure. So when you say your IQ would go up, though, I would like to see this done against other things like that, you know, other.
Well, and he did that. He did that with the drama class, and the drama class actually didn't improve IQ. But the interesting thing here, but again, a lot of
it
people say
the
sample
though.
Size was too small, and yeah, it did show other things. But the interesting thing here that we didn't even talk about is that using IQ as your outcome measure is by itself problematic.
Sure.
What are you actually measuring there?
Don't even ask me. I don't even know if IQ is legit.
We could talk about this for another hour.
It's measuring something. IQ is measuring something.
Of course it is.
But it's not measuring something that is generic intelligence, right? It's measuring certain specific abilities.
Throw out your baby Mozart discs.
Right. That's a touch total BS. And remember the concept of external validity, right? You have to show that what you're measuring means something in the real world. It predicts something, like and something useful. Like performance academically, or performance in a job, or how much money you're going to make in your lifetime, right? Or something, right? You're connecting
IQ
it to some external. Yeah, it does.
A lot of external validity. I mean, yeah, it's highly correlated with like you said, academic success. It's highly correlated with ability to earn money, with life skills, like all of that.
Yeah, it's measuring something real. It's just you don't think of it as general intelligence. It's measuring some specific things. All right, Jay, tell us why the measles infection is so bad.
Steve, nobody knows why kids can put really gross crap in their mouth and they do all this stuff. You know, they do things. Steve has noticed that every time my kids were caught picking their nose and eating it, Steve would remind me and my wife that it's actually good for their immune system.
I was about to say that. It's not that gross. I feel like of the gross things kids do, that's one of the least gross things.
But I mean, kids would. Kids put things in their mouths, right?
I picked my nose and ate it once when I was a little kid. I hated it and never did it again.
And he never went back to it.
The appeal.
When I was in pre-K, I put a penny in my mouth because it tasted weird. And I was like sucking on it. And then I accidentally kind of half swallowed it and I almost died. I was like choking. And I was so scared and I was so embarrassed to tell anybody. I stood over the water fountain and stuck my finger down my throat and fished it out. And it was probably the scariest I've ever been in my life. And I still remember that memory.
You still have it?
I mean, if you're going to die, you at least want to die with a half dollar in your
throat.
Yeah,
exactly.
You
know, not
be a penny.
Penny, come on.
So, you know, look, we're surrounded, like we said, we have a cloud of bacteria around us.
I love mine. Yeah.
And a young person's immune system is constantly building up an immune defense. You know, like it encounters a germ. And then the body can learn and memorize a way of fighting that germ. And the way that that works is we create antibodies. And, you know, the antibody is specifically designed to fight a certain molecule. You know, if the body gets infected again, that the body, your body can fight it off very quickly. So, you know, kids are developing their immune system as they grow up and they build a catalog of defenses, right? We need this. Without our ability, you ever see the boy in the plastic bubble? Remember that from the 70s?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people that have compromised immune systems. They can't live
Wasn't
in
that John Travolta?
The world. It was John Travolta.
I believe it was John Travolta, yeah.
They can't live in the germ-infested world that we live in.
I think he had Saturday Night Fever or something.
Yeah, you're right. So,
nice.
How did you get me on that? So when a child gets the measles, what the measles can do, and I didn't see how often it happens, and I think it's very standard that what the measles does is it something called immunological amnesia happens. This means that the catalog of information that the child's body has developed, like the catalog of antibodies or the ability to develop and grow antibodies that they've learned, gets destroyed.
Can I ask you a question, though? Why is it the measles and not measles?
I don't know. The measles.
Yeah, it's measles. The measles. Whatever. Measles. It's the measles.
All right. So doctors say measles. I say the measles. Okay. I will say measles from now on.
I like the measles.
Yeah. So
the Kara likes the measles.
I do. She does.
So what we found is that there are two new studies that came out. Recently, this new study was published in Science Immunology, and it concluded that the measles virus destroys specific subsets of immune cells, or you know, you can call this antibody memory. This means that those immune cells that are responsible for pumping out the actual antibodies no longer know how to create them. So the measles can destroy up to 73% of a child's learned antibodies. This is one of the incredible reasons and important reasons why there should be very strict rules against who can legitimately opt out of a measles vaccination, right? You know, the whole religious exemption and whatever, that is such complete nonsense when you think about what it's actually doing to your children. Your child isn't getting the measles and then getting better, and then everything is back to the way that it was. The only thing that happens after a child gets measles is they develop an immunity to future measles. That's it. Everything else about the measles is bad, especially this. This is the thing that can lead to a child dying. They can get the measles, and then next thing you know, they get hit with something a lot less. A flu could take them out.
Yeah, so just I read through the original article, not just the press discussion of it, because it does get a little technical. So just to be a little bit more specific, what's actually happening is that the measles virus is infecting the memory B cells, right? So those are the cells that remember, that make specific antibodies to a previously exposed antigen. And so if you kill that memory B cell, then you forget that immunity, right? The immunity to whatever it was that B cell makes antibodies for. And this is not uncommon. A lot of viruses have developed, they evolved the ability to take out the immune system in one way or another as a preemptive strike that makes them more infectious, right? Because they're actually weakening the immune system so that they can't be fought as effectively. that's what HIV is, right? HIV is just a really effective, you know, way of taking out the immune system. The study found that in the subjects that they looked at, they lost, it was between 10 and 70%. It was up to 70%, but it was also as low as 10% of the, so they took children who were not vaccinated. They did an antibody survey. They said, okay, let's see how many different kinds of antibodies are they producing. Then for those who happened to contract the measles, they looked at them afterwards, and they were missing between 10 and 70% of the antibodies that they had previously had. Now, they didn't follow up, so they don't know how long this effect lasts. And it does seem like you do recover from this. You start to, rebuild up your immune system. But there is evidence that for an increased risk of dying from infections 2 to 3 years after getting measles. Oh,
wow. I read up to 5 years, Steve.
Wow. Yeah, so it could be even longer. So this reduced immunity statistically lasts for several years, right? We could say that. So we need to do more studies to try to quantify this a little bit more accurately, but that's a pretty significant effect. So this actually, leaves children who are infected more vulnerable, to other infections up to several years. This is a serious complication, side effect of this disease.
Yeah, the thing that I would like to hear more data on is, it said the subsets, what specific things is the measles infection hurting? Mm-hmm. Can they get specific? I would love to know. Like, what's it actually wiping out?
It's the memory B cells. It's a very it's a specific kind of cell in the immune system that remembers previous exposures.
I got that, but I mean, I want it more tangible, like street language, like the flu, or it could be indiscriminate. It could be anything.
I think it's indiscriminate. I mean, if it's 70%, it's like, if it's up to 70%, that's pretty much indiscriminate. That's a good question. Is it targeting specific B cells, or is it really just, what I would suspect is that it has the ability to bind to something on that type of B cell, but not know what a specific B cell is, confers immunity to. So it's probably just targeting that subtype of, white cell. The other thing to note, sort of buried in the article, in the actual research paper itself, was that they also studied children who were vaccinated for measles, got the MMR vaccine, and that did not decrease their antibody repertoire. So getting vaccinated does not have the same effect. Getting the infection does. And that's important because a very common anti-vaccine talking point is that it's better to get the infection than the vaccine. The infection gives you better immunity than the vaccine. Well, and that is highly misleading. Mm-hmm. It may be literally true that sometimes you get longer immunity from a serious infection than from getting the vaccine because the...
But at what cost?
Yeah, but at what cost? First of all, you may not need it, or the answer is you get a booster vaccine, right?
Yeah.
So we know this. Yeah, getting a vaccine's it doesn't stress your immune system the same way surviving an entire infection does, sure. But but you get basically free antibodies with the vaccine, whereas you don't have to suffer through the infection and all the complications. And now here's another complication of an infection. It actually leaves your immune system weakened. That's the exact opposite of the anti-vax propaganda. So that's a critical finding.
Did you guys watch, do you remember that HBO miniseries, John Adams?
Oh, yes.
Yep, very good.
Do you remember the episode where they were going through the whole smallpox thing? Yeah. Yes.
Yep, and they cut them on the arm.
Yeah, the early smallpox, quote-unquote, vaccine was basically just low-grade smallpox infection.
It was the cowpox. So
it
was not a vaccine. Yeah. It was an inoculation.
It was an inoculation.
Yeah.
Inoculation.
So they were inoculated with cowpox, which was similar enough to smallpox that it would give you some crossover immunity, enough that you would have a greater chance of surviving an infection if you got it.
And but so also, some people got brutally sick from the cowpox, remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was horrible.
They didn't die.
Why would you do that to yourself if you had a perfectly good... They didn't yet, but that's what I'm saying. I wouldn't want to live in a world where you had to give yourself a mild infection or even a moderate infection to avoid a more brutal infection. I much prefer no infection.
Yeah.
1700s was a tough time.
Exactly.
But hey, the cowpox inoculation was a huge advance. I mean, that was
massive.
Massive, yeah.
But that's kind of the point I'm trying to make, is that what I consider kind of a pre-vaccine or an early iteration of a vaccine, maybe that's a good way to put it, an inoculation, which now oftentimes, don't we use those words interchangeably?
No. Maybe the lay public does, but
they actually mean something different.
Yeah, they mean something
different. And Steve's not lay.
In that same John Adams series,
Steve has no lay.
They showed John Adams undergoing a bloodletting as well. So bloodletting was still happening at the time.
Yeah, fun. Fun.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of anti-vaxxers, anybody see that recent episode of Bill Maher?
No, but we got enough emails about it.
Didn't have to.
Got a ton of emails about it.
They did the ugly work, and they just told us about it.
Steve,
what's the deal with that dude? What's going on, man?
Yeah, so he had on Dr. Jay Gordon, who was an infamous anti-vaccine pediatrician, but he insists he's not anti-vaccine. He's functionally anti-vaccine, but this is the game that many anti-vaxxers play. They're coy. They say, I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm just pro-safe vaccine. Of course, no vaccines are safe in their eyes, and so they're functionally anti-vaccine. Okay. So it was a sweetheart interview. You know, Maher did not challenge him on any of his views because Maher shares them, right? But again, Maher's trying to present himself as the reasonable person. So this is sort of the money quote of the interview. This is Bill Maher speaking now. You know, to call you this crazy person, really, what you're just saying is slower, maybe less numbers, should be fewer, and also take into account individuals. People are different, family history, stuff like that. I don't think this is crazy. The autism issue, they certainly have studied it a million times, and yet there's all these parents who say, I had a normal child, got the vaccine. This story keeps coming up. It seems to be more realistic to me if we're just going to be realistic about it.
That's coming from ignorance.
What?
Right there.
It's the same old garbage.
Name that logical fallacy.
Oh, my God.
So that's like riddled. Let's deconstruct this one paragraph
here
a little
bit. One sentence at a time? Okay.
Yeah, so he's saying, yeah, maybe we should give the vaccine schedule more slowly and give fewer vaccines. So that's basically the too many, too soon mantra of the anti-vaxxers, right? That's right out of the anti-vaccine playbook. Too many, too soon, right? They're good with slogans. So obviously, if you think that we're giving too many too soon, you want to give fewer and slower, right? So that's what he's saying. Now, Dr. Gordon will do that. They'll give alternative vaccine schedules. A lot of these, you know, the anti-vaccine pediatricians, you know, will do that. But this has been studied. So first of all, the vaccine schedule is not arbitrary, right? It's evidence-based. It's based upon when are children able to get these vaccines and when are they at risk for these diseases. And if you delay the vaccines, and this has been studied, right? If you do the alternative schedules where you give slower, fewer vaccines, there is absolutely no benefit to the child, right? There is no, you are not avoiding anything. There's no reduction in any negative outcome, except there's an increase in the risk of vaccine preventable diseases. So that's it.
Defeats the purpose.
So we've proven.
But of course, nobody was sitting there across from them saying that.
No, of course
not. There
wasn't
anybody to go, oh, nope, wait, let me, nope, not on that point. Oh,
it was one anti-vaxxer interviewing another anti-vaxxer. And so, yeah, if you delay vaccines, all you're doing is increasing the risk for diseases. You're not reducing any side effects or reducing any negative outcomes. So that that's evidence. We have that evidence. It's pretty solid. So that's just nonsense. Then the second point is people are different, family history, stuff like that. So what he's saying is we should individualize treatment to the patient. Wow. What an idea.
Like, never
doctors
thought of that
don't
before,
do
right?
that already.
I know. That's exactly.
They're not holistic, you see.
That's like so insulting.
I know. It's so basic. I mean, it's so every expert. I mean, anyone who has any expertise has that experience where somebody who is outside of their expertise asks questions like, why don't you just do X? Like, As if it were so simple. So, oh yeah, you're right. You thousands and thousands of experts who have dedicated their life to this never thought of that. You're a genius.
And what does that really mean? Like, sure, it's individualized in the sense that if you're allergic to albumin, you get an albumin-free vaccine. If you have an immune, you know, deficiency and you're not able to take a vaccine, your doctor knows that and either writes you a
don't
waiver.
Get it.
Or said, yeah, like it's not recommended for you. Like it's individualized as far as you're willing to actually work with your physician and say, this is where I'm at. This is how I feel. And your physician will say, you are a good candidate for all of these vaccines. You should get them.
Yeah. You know, family history is a standard part of every patient history. Family history is one of the sections.
Do this.
I know. Your past medical history, any history of negative reactions to other vaccines or whatever. It's all right there. And now we're trying to get into genetic individualization, like actually testing people's DNA and saying, oh, you have a mutation or a variant that would make you more susceptible to this drug or that one or whatever. But that's a work in progress very much so. But this is part and parcel of science-based medicine is individualizing treatments which are based upon statistical information to the individual patient. So the idea that this is some kind of new idea is nonsense. Yeah.
And there are vaccines, right, that like especially with flu is what I'm thinking. But Steve, you'll know this. There are certain vaccines where it comes in different forms. Like there's the nasal flu vaccine and there's the injectable. And like those are indicated for different people based on their age or based on their wellness or whatever, right?
I mean, there's sometimes when you wouldn't give a live attenuated virus vaccine, for example. You would only give an inactivated vaccine in certain patient populations. And like if there are patients, like I have patients with autoimmune disease. And we study, like, do you give the flu vaccine to somebody who has an autoimmune disease? Is that going to trigger their autoimmune disease? And there are very specific algorithm-based guidelines about who gets it and who doesn't get it based on risk versus benefit. We individualize in a way that is orders of magnitude more sophisticated than Bill Maher's thinking about this topic.
I also think it's what's most insulting to me is this idea that like, because this is what happens. It's almost easier to deal with somebody who's like an all-in, like crank anti-vaxxer, who's like never vaccinate. It's a government, it's like a fluoride in the water. You know, they want our vital essences kind of people. Yeah. Because then you're like, okay, this is like pure banana rama, but like whatever, I can work with this. But when people try to do the whole like measured, and I'm just saying there's too many, and I'm just saying we need to be a little more cautious. It basically, I feel like what they're saying to me is that I'm like vaccine hungry. Like I'm the one to go out and gobble up all the vaccines. And it's
it's definitely based on a straw man.
I have a measured approach to using vaccines. I use the ones that I need. I use the ones that will prevent me from having illnesses that will make me brutally ill or potentially die.
Yeah, right.
That's what I do already. So thank you. We're both doing that.
Let's move on. They're only pretending to do that. That's cover for their anti-vaccine ideology.
Exactly, yeah.
We're actually doing it. The next line, the autism issue. They certainly have studied it a million times, and yet there's all these parents. So basically he's saying, yes, there's this mountain of scientific evidence that shows that there's no correlation between autism and any specific vaccine or any vaccine ingredient. But there's all this anecdotal evidence. And if we're just going to be realistic, like he's like, if we're just going to be realistic, we should listen to the anecdotal evidence over the scientific evidence.
Yeah,
That's what he's saying. So
he's completely ignoring everything we know about the age at which people get vaccines, the age at which symptoms of autism start to, that there's a high, you know, like correlation between those two things. Like there's a massive intervening variable here. And for some reason, everybody wants to pretend that doesn't exist.
Yeah, but it's even worse than that, Kara, because actually, if you really study kids carefully, they manifest autism at 6 months old.
True.
And before they get most of their vaccines.
Yeah, but it's more perceptible the older they get, right? Like they're going to really start seeing
it's diagnosed.
Kids are learning to speak and
Diagnosed often after they get most of the vaccines. But if you look, they actually are, it's present before they get them. So the cause and effect doesn't really make sense. So they say, well, maybe it's the vaccines that the mother got. Okay, that's a nice way to move the goalpost there. But,
I can probably think of 9,000 other things that happen in a developing child's life and environment at that time that you could just as easily say were the, quote, cause of their autism.
Right. But again, the whole pregnancy vaccines has been studied as well. And there's no correlation there. And also the other thing is there's a tremendous amount of evidence that it's dominantly genetic. Sure, genes interact with the environment. There may be environmental risk factors, whatever, but it's basically a genetic disorder. But they don't want to hear that because that doesn't fit their ideology. So they dismiss the genetic evidence. And I haven't really ever read an anti-vaxxer have a good reason for dismissing the genetic evidence. They typically say something like, oh, those doctors are obsessed with genetics. That's literally their answer.
Well, the thing that's so frustrating is that let's say we didn't know that there was a genetic link and it was still an open-ended question. And there's still some variants that we haven't been able to account for, right? But let's say that we didn't even know that and 90% of the variants was still unaccounted for. We did not know what caused autism. What we know for damn certain is it's not vaccines.
Right.
That we have actually been able to show does not cause autism. We have disconfirming evidence of that. Move the F on.
No, I agree. So there are generic problems here. There's distrust of experts, distrust of the medical establishment, and also buying into certain marketed narratives like the appeal to nature fallacy, chemophobia, fear of anything artificial or chemical, et cetera. And now, of course, then the very specific narratives that the anti-vaccine movement is developing, like as we discussed, like you're better off getting the infection than the vaccine, which is not true. And they just have built this alternate reality, you know?
And it promotes all sorts of fringe charlatan treatments and cures and, you know, naturopaths and non-doctor doctors that, just take 500 supplements a day. You'll be fine.
It becomes the Wild West, basically.
And I have to say, shame on Bill Maher for being so persistently ill-informed on this topic. He's been corrected so many times.
Willfully ignorant.
Yeah, that this, he really should do better.
Well, I think what I can say about it is simply the only thing really that I'm comfortable saying about it is that this is a sacred cow. It is not just, I don't know. It's I'm actively, passionately believing this. It is a sacred cow.
All right. I'm sure this isn't the last we're going to hear of this topic. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy. I just love noises.
Is that sped up? It doesn't sound like it's a...
No, it's totally real.
That's its actual pace.
Yeah.
Okay.
And is that you take some kind of data and you turn it into an audio version?
No, I promised I would always tell people.
Yeah, that's right. But that's not that.
That's not that.
It does sound fairly random. Not totally, but I mean,
think it sounds sweet. It does. Kind of sad.
It does have a little sadness to it, too. Isn't that
it's
funny?
A sad droid.
Yeah, it's like R2 whistling to himself or something.
Yeah, there's a loneliness to this robotic song.
We did not get a lot of guesses, and I think because it was really difficult. This was a hard one. So we got a guess from iPuppy. You've heard the name before. This person has been writing in quite a bit. This guy's name is Brian. Brian said, Jay, well, I hope I'm not as spectacularly and uniquely wrong as last week. This week's noisy is some sort of sequence of control tone sent over a communication system. Since that's probably too general a guess, I'll take a shot in the dark and say it's commands sent from ground control to the Apollo spacecraft.
It's a major
or time. Not, regards Brian.
Or not.
That is incorrect.
Well, no, it is correct because it is not that.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, his guesses are incorrect. His first guess saying that these are sequences of control tones sent over a communication system. Sorry, that is so general. That could be anything. But keep guessing. You'll get there, man. You're gonna do fine. I predict you get a correct one before the year is done. Another listener, Bob, loves this person's name. It's Visto Tutti.
Yeah.
And Visto says, this week's noisy sounds like the audio monitor on a very early computer. These early computers did not have a visual display like today's computers. To check if the program was running as expected or gotten stuck in a loop, technicians would hook up a speaker to produce sounds as the address and data signals changed during a program run. Back in the 1950s, some programmers wrote code specifically to produce sounds like music. I'm sure someone played Daisy Daisy Give Me Your Answer Do at some point. Okay, so that's pretty cool. That's not correct. But that is a pretty cool and very true statement that Visto is talking about, how they would use sound to help them figure out what problems are going on. My God. No monitor. No monitors on a computer. Let's forget about it. Forget it.
Yeah, you want a days. World with no cell phones.
No, I didn't say I want a world with no cell phones. I would like people to not be so obsessed and, you know, like every, you know, you can't be bored in this world. You have to pull out your phone. Oh, my God.
That's
you know,
fair.
Standing in line, pull out your phone. Waiting for my wife to get out of the bathroom, pull out the phone. You know, it's like, get the hell out of here with this. But it happened to the days when we would talk to strangers, you know? I got a really cool thing, though. I'm going to give this person the win. I've never done this before. But they gave me, since there was just no way anybody was winning this week, I gave this person the win because they sent me in something very fun. And I just appreciate what they did. So Dr. Michael H. Valkenberg wrote in. He says, yeah, I have a small noisy for you. He says, now this is, of course, a bit boring. The story behind it is that I read a Boing Boing story about open source software that allows you to separate music from vocals and songs. And to cut to the chase, he sent in this noisy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Is that you?
No, it's not. I want you to guess. Who is that? When I hear it, I can tell you who it is in a second. I know exactly what it's from.
Can you play it one more time?
Listen again.
Is it what you're emulating?
Oh, it's John. It's John Cougar. Oh,
yeah. It's John Cougar. It's John Cougar. Yeah. Oh yeah. Life goes on. Yeah. So he stripped the vocals out for that, and I said I have no winner this week. You know what, Dr. Michael H. Valkenberg, if that's your real name, I am awarding you the winnership of this week because you did some work for me. Because the guy, it took him a while. I said he fell down a rabbit hole and he spent like 4 hours or something trying to get stripped
so
out.
So you're giving him a pity win. Is that what it is?
No, I'm giving him a
pride win.
Thank you. Thank you for appreciating the, oh yeah, the funny jokes that we have on the show. And the, you know, and he, yeah. You know, he played along in all his right. own way. So let me tell you what this one is. This was sent in by the original noisy was sent in by a listener named Alan Wells. And Alan said that beeping noise, he said he's from the UK and I've just come across the attached sound. It should be a good one. It's a directional radio antenna locator used for finding locations of breaks and pipes, among other things. It uses a tag on one end of a tethered inspection camera, for example, and then pinpoints the location and depth given feedback to the user with awesome tunes. So this device essentially like would help people that are in construction or trying to solve a problem, say in a pipeline or a sewage system or whatever, where you know the line was breached. It's just a feedback that tells you information. You have to be able to listen to it and understand what it means. Like you have to be trained and to understand what the beeping means. But that's the little guy chugging along there. All right, a new sound for you people this week. Petteri Rinn. This person says, howdy, if anything, this should brighten your day. And they sent in a very interesting noisy, and I'm going to play it for you. And here it is.
It's so John Cougar?
It just looks like, yeah, John Cougar. After he drank a case of beer. So if you think you know what this noisy is, if you think you've heard a cool noisy, what do you, you know, you're on a lunch break, you're on your way out of the job, you're driving home, send me an email right now. Come on, you heard something cool this week. Send it to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, guys, let's move on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fake news. Are you guys ready for this week? Three regular items, no theme. Here we go. Item number one. A new review of published research concludes that one medium-sized potted plant per average household room purifies the air as well as standard ventilation. Item number two, researchers detail the mechanisms by which some bacteria directly feed on electricity for energy. And item number three, a new study finds that flagging news items on Facebook as fake has no effect on whether subjects thought they were true, which was entirely determined by alignment with their existing beliefs, regardless of their party affiliation. Let me unpack that a bit, because I just had to cram it into one sentence. But basically, the subjects believed the news items on Facebook, irrespective of whether or not they were flagged as fake, as long as they were in line with their ideology, whether that ideology was on the left or the right end of the political spectrum. Everyone got that?
Yep.
All right. Kara, go first.
First off, my spidey senses, my skeptical senses are tingling on this houseplant one, like right off the bat, just as soon as you read it. Like, I just feel like, no, don't really know, but think one medium-sized potted plant per household room purifies the air as well as it's. I think that's just not true. Ventilation is awesome. It's all scientifical. I don't know, man. Just having a plant in the room purifies the air. Like, how would that even work? All they do is respire and then photosynthesize, and then they respire again, so they use most of what they put out. Researchers detail the mechanisms by which some bacteria directly feed on electricity for energy. What does that mean?
They eat electricity.
Well, I mean, okay, that sounds crazy, but also it's not that crazy because they actually do produce like ADP. They produce cellular energy. They utilize, like, depending, you know, we eat food, but like plants utilize sun energy. It's like it's all different energy currencies. Yes, okay, electricity, that's weird, but isn't it really just about electrons? I don't know. It sounds crazy, but I feel like that's more reasonable. The last one makes me really sad because in the depths of my broken soul, I feel like this one is science. And that bums me out. That flagging news items as fake doesn't affect anybody. But it's, I feel like the conversation we just talked about is a good example of that. Like being like, but the data, oh yeah, but if we want to be reasonable, we should probably listen to the anecdotes.
But go with your gut.
So yeah, exactly. I feel like Facebook is the epitome of truthiness. I mean, it's where the, you know, election tampering, it was like ground zero for all of this stuff. So I'm going to say the houseplant one is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, I mean, this potted, medium-sized potted plant, okay, does it matter which plant it is? Not all plants are the same, so you would have to have a particular plant, I suppose, but what plant could do the work of a ventilation system? I just don't see it. But I also don't see how bacteria is directly feeding on electricity. Where are they getting that from? Just out of the air, static in the air, electrons in the air, maybe. Carpet shock? Carpet bacteria. And then the Facebook one, yeah, you know, of the three, I think that's the least fiction-y one, as Kara said, unfortunately. So I'm not too far apart on Kara on any of this stuff. And therefore, she's blazing a trail. I'm going with her.
Ooh.
Potted. I am not a potted plant.
Danger zone.
Okay, Jay.
I think that, like nanomachines, we can never question what they're capable of. I think bacteria can... Yeah, there could be bacteria that feed off electricity. As weird as it sounds, you know, bacteria are so unbelievably capable of developing the tools they need to live in any environment. So anyway, yeah, that one, I'll just push that one aside saying sure. The one about the potted plants, I mean, when you say purifies the air, that could mean a lot of different things. And I don't think that a potted plant is purifying the air where it's taking particulate out of the air like dust and, the skin that drops off of people every second that we're in a room.
That's
and
called dander.
That's, you know, purifying it. It's too vague a term. I'm really just not even going to talk about the third one. I think that one's the fiction.
The third one?
The Facebook one?
The first one is the fiction. The potted plant is the fiction.
Yeah. You were very ambiguous in the way you say that. But you want the plant is the fiction. All right. And Bob.
Fiction.
Yeah, bacteria don't surprise me. And that one's actually ringing a bell. Third one, yeah, it just seems to – it just is in sync with what I know how people and how ridiculous they are. yeah, the first one – and I agree with Jay mostly because the word purifies, I think, is the active word here. How much purification, you know, what does that mean? And what does air handling, you know, what does standard ventilation do for purification compared to potted plants? So I'll say that one's fiction too.
All right. So you guys all agree on number one. So I'm going to take these in reverse order. We'll start with three. A new study finds that flagging news items on Facebook as fake has no effect on whether subjects thought they were true, which was entirely determined by alignment with their existing beliefs, regardless of their party affiliation. You guys all think this one is science, but did I get you in a meta science or fiction by making you think the one that's in line with your ideology is true?
Yeah, gosh. Be surprised. Wouldn't be the first time.
But this one is science. Now, this one is depressing.
Oh, it's so sad.
Bad science. Yeah. Very bad, very bad.
It's very bad, yeah. So they took a convenience sample of undergraduate students who were social media users, and they showed them various new Facebook items. Some were obviously true, and those were the control items. And then they had some that were true and some that were not true, and they were randomly flagged as fake, right? So they were flagged at random as fake. And they tested the subjects for their political ideology ahead of time, and the news items were political in nature. And so the question was what influenced whether or not they thought the item was true or not true. The flagging had zero statistical effect on whether or not they thought they were true or not. If they were in line with their measured political ideology, they thought they were true. And if they were not in line, they thought they were fake. And that was it. And that was true for both Republicans and Democrats. It didn't matter what side of the spectrum that they were on. They also did another thing. They were, while the subjects were doing this, they were looking at their brain activity with an EEG. But really, the only thing that showed is there was sort of more frontal lobe activity when they... and they took longer to answer when they saw an item that was flagged as fake, but that was in line with their ideology, that caused them to increase their frontal lobe activity and delayed their response. So
they thought about it for a second, but they were still like, nah.
Yes. They thought about it. So they had to come up with a reason why, they basically were having cognitive dissonance. They had to resolve their cognitive dissonance, which they all did without any problem, and they still just went with whatever was in line with their ideology.
Theodoric of York.
Yeah.
Nah. Yikes.
Okay, but this is one study in a very large and growing literature on this sort of thing. So this is not like the one and only final word on this, but most of the studies are basically in line with this. Okay, let's go on to number two. Researchers detail the mechanisms by which some bacteria directly feed on electricity for energy. You guys all think this one is science. You guys think that there is, can bacteria truly do anything? Or am I just playing on the fact that you all think that bacteria can do anything? This one is... science.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Some bacteria. Super bacteria. So there's a bacteria.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Not all bacteria, just certain species evolved to eat electricity. And Kara, you pretty much nailed it. It is just another energy currency, and they are in fact eating electrons.
Yay, cool.
Which is what, that's how we produce ATP, right? It's the electron transport chain. Where do the electrons come from? So if you could harvest electrons directly, then you could just feed that into your electron transport chain and make ATP that way. So that's basically what they do. The real key was, how do they get the electrons from the outside to the inside? Because the membrane should keep that from happening.
They just whistle.
No, it's not. They had to develop, evolve specific adaptations to their membrane to produce a conduit, basically, to suck those electrons in. And that's what the study was showing, right?
Like a little pore or something.
Yeah, contains a little bit of iron.
Cool.
Which conducts the electron, yeah. So,
what if iron. We could do that?
This doesn't mean that they exclusively rely on electrons for energy, because they also need nutrients, right? They need physical nutrients to build stuff with. So they still have to eat, but they can use electricity, the flow of electrons, which is electricity, directly for energy. Pretty cool.
That's cool.
Bacteria, baby. Yeah. Oh, are you sure it was bacteria, not archaea?
Yeah. Well, it says bacteria.
Okay.
It does say it.
Study. Okay. That all means a new review of published research concludes that one medium-sized pot of plants per average household room purifies the air as well as standard ventilation is the fiction. I underestimated the degree to which you guys have heard this myth before. Maybe I didn't. Because this is something that's very frequently claimed you should have plants in your house that'll purify the air. Now, purify has a very specific meaning. It means remove stuff from the air. It's not recycling the carbon dioxide and making oxygen. That's respiration. It's just removing pollution.
It's like a filtration system.
Plants eat pollution?
They do, actually. And in fact, by coincidence, there was another study that I came across today that showed that one of the most effective way to reduce pollution from industry is to plant a lot of trees around them. Because trees, right at that, will absorb a lot of pollution from the air.
Right, and they're probably like a heavy carbon sink.
Well, they are, but this is separate from the carbon sink, right?
Okay,
this
is, it's not just like emissions, like carbon emissions.
No, it's not just carbon. It's like actual pollution,
soot and other things.
Yeah, and organic pollutants and carbon. Things like that.
But I feel you.
But the plants will purify the air in your home, but the question was how much. Right? And the answer is not much. So it's really insignificant. What the study found was that, and you're right, Kara, the standard ventilation is ridiculously effective at clearing, contaminants and from the air, purifying the air. So the reason why plants don't do much by comparison is because ventilation is just really effective.
Well, how many plants would you need to match modern air?
They calculate between 100 and 1,000 plants per square meter of floor space.
Oh, my God.
Microplants.
Yeah. You have to live in more than a greenhouse. Yeah, very overstuffed greenhouse.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. So, that's why it's basically not at all, right? So having like any normal amount of plants in your house, even a lot, is not going to do anything in terms of purifying the air. You need ventilation.
If you have a lot of flowers in your house, it will cover the smell of the horrible stench of the stagnant.
It does. I have a dwarf lemon tree in my office, and when it blooms, the lemon blossoms are awesome.
How often does it bloom?
Well, I've only had it for a little while. It's done it once so far.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll let you know when it does it a second time.
I love that smell. It's so good.
Yeah, it's good. But it's not going to purify the air. You still need to move the air around. All right. Well, good job, guys.
Yay.
Thank you. Thank you, Kara. Woo-hoo.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
There are so many ways to be involved in science. And what I really need out there across the world is people that just appreciate the idea that the universe is so beautiful that we can work together to understand it. Whatever you're doing in life, you can be part of that adventure. Michelle Thaler, Assistant Director for Science Communication at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, she's super cool.
Love seeing her on TV and all those shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's so a good science communicator. Yeah, really good.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.